woman by the shoulder and got her walking toward intake, where Norcross and Coates met her. Once inside, the process would begin. The woman brushed at the flyer, circling her hair, and as she did so, her wide mouth opened and she tilted her head to the sky, and Jeanette saw her laugh, saw her bright, straight teeth. Peters began to buck against her, and his ejaculate pumped into her hand. He stepped back. His cheeks were flushed. There was a smile on his fat little face as he zipped up his fly. "Wipe that on the back of the Coke machine, Sorley, and then finish mopping the fucking floor." Jeanette wiped his semen away, then pushed the mop bucket back down to the sink so she could rinse off her hand. When she came back, Peters was sitting at one of the tables and drinking a Coke.
"You okay?"
Ree whispered.
"Yes,"
Jeanette whispered back. And she would be, as soon as she got some aspirin for her head. The last 4 minutes hadn't even happened. She had been watching the woman get out of the police cruiser, that was all. She didn't need to think about the last 4 minutes ever again. She just needed to see Bobby on his next visit.
"St, st," went the shooter of the polish can.
3 or 4 seconds of blessed silence elapsed before Ree checked in again.
"Did you see the new one?"
"Yes."
"Was she beautiful or was that just me?"
"She was beautiful."
"Those county Mounties drew their guns, you see that?"
"Yes." Jeanette glanced at Peters, who had clicked on the television and was now staring at some news report. The picture showed someone slumped behind the wheel of a car. It was hard to tell if it was a man or woman because he or she seemed to be wrapped in gauze. On the bottom of the screen, "Breaking News" was flashing on and off in red, but that meant nothing. They called it breaking news if Kim Kardashian farted. Jeanette blinked back the water that had suddenly welled up in her eyes.
"What do you think she did?"
She cleared her throat, sucking back the tears.
"No idea." "You sure you're all right?"
Before Jeanette could reply, Peter spoke without turning his head.
"You two ladies stop gossiping or you're both going on bad report."
And because Ree couldn't stop talking, it just wasn't in her. Jeanette mopped her way down to the far end of the room. On TV, Michaela Morgan said, "The president so far has declined to declare a state of emergency, but informed sources close to the crisis say that..." Jeanette tuned her out. The new fish had raised her cuffed hands to the circling moths and laughed when they alit. "You'll lose that laugh in here, sister," Jeanette thought. "We all do." 4. Anton Dubček returned home for lunch. This was customary, and though it was only 12:30, it was actually a late lunch by Anton's standards. He had been hard at work since 6 that morning. What people didn't understand about pool maintenance was that it was not a business for softies. You had to be driven. If you wanted to succeed in pools, you couldn't sleep in, dreaming about blintzes and blowjobs. To stay ahead of the competition, you had to stay ahead of the sun. At this point in his day, he had swept and adjusted the levels and cleaned out the filters of 7 different pools and replaced the gaskets on 2 pumps. He could save the remaining 4 appointments on his schedule for late afternoon and early evening. In between, lunch, a short nap, a short workout, and perhaps a brief visit to Jessica Elway, the bored married chick he was currently boning. That her husband was a local deputy dog made it all the sweeter. Cops sat in their cars all day and snarfed donuts and got their jollies harassing black guys. Anton controlled the motherfucking waters and made money. Anton dropped his keys in the bowl by the door and proceeded straight to the fridge to get his shake. He shifted around the soy milk, the bag of kale, the container of berries. No shake.
"Mom? Mom!"
he cried out. "Where's my shake?" There was no answer, but he heard the television going in the living room. Anton poked his head through the open doorway. The evidence on display, television playing, empty rocks glass, suggested that Magda had retired for a snooze of her own. As much as he loved his mother, Anton knew she drank too much. It made her sloppy, and that pissed him off. Since his dad died, it was Anton who paid the mortgage. Upkeep and sustenance was her end of the bargain. If he didn't have his shakes, Anton couldn't dominate pools the way he needed to, or excel to the maximum in his workouts, or slam a juicy ass as forcefully as the ladies wanted him to slam it.
"Mom, this is bullshit! You gotta do your part!"
his voice echoed through the house. From the cabinet under the silverware drawer, he yanked out his blender, creating as much of a racket as possible as he thumped it down on the counter and pieced together jar, blade, and base. Anton dropped in a good bunch of greens, some berries, a handful of nuts, a spoonful of organic peanut butter, and a cup of Mr. Ripper protein powder, TM. While he performed this assembly, he found himself pondering Chief Lila Norcross. She was attractive for an older chick, extremely fit, a true yummy mummy, no donuts for her, and he liked the way she rallied when he gave her a line. Did she want him? Or did she want to commit acts of police brutality against him? Or, and this was the truly intriguing possibility, did she both want him and want to commit acts of police brutality against him? The situation bore monitoring. Anton set the blender to the highest speed and watched the mix blur. Once it was a smooth pea color, he flicked off the power, removed the jar, and headed into the living room. And on the screen, what did you know? His old playmate, Mickey Coates. He liked Mickey, although the sight of her induced uncharacteristically melancholy feelings in the president, CEO, CFO, and sole employee of Anton the Pool Guy, LLC. Would she even remember him? His mother used to babysit her, so in their early years they had been thrust together quite a lot. Anton remembered Mickey exploring his bedroom, looking through his drawers, flipping through the comics, tossing out one inquiry after another. Who gave you this? Why is this G.I. Joe your favorite? Why don't you have a calendar? Your dad's an electrician, right? Do you think he'll teach you how to do wires and stuff? Do you want him to? They must have been about 8, and it was like she was planning to write his biography. That was okay, though. Good, in fact. Her interest had made Anton feel special. Before that, before her, he had never even wanted someone else's interest, had been happy just being a kid. Of course, Mickey'd gone off to private school early on, and from junior high onward, they'd hardly spoken. Probably as an adult, she was into briefcase and cufflink types who read the Wall Street Journal, who understood whatever the hell the appeal of opera was, who watched shows on PBS, that sort of guy. Anton shook his head. Her loss, he assured himself. I want to warn you that the footage you're about to see is disturbing, and we haven't confirmed its authenticity. Mickey was reporting from a seat in the rear of a news van with the door open. Beside her was a man in a headset working on a laptop. Mickey's blue eyeshadow was visibly damp. It must have been hot in the van. Her face looked different, somehow. Anton took a large foamy gulp of his shake and studied her. However, she continued, in light of everything surrounding Aurora and the rumors of adverse reactions by sleepers who have been aroused, we've decided to run it because it would seem to confirm that those reports are accurate. Here's the section of footage recorded from the streaming site maintained by the self-proclaimed Bright Ones from their compound outside of Hatch, New Mexico. As you know, this militia group has been at odds with federal authorities over water rights. Good to see Mickey, but the news bored Anton. He picked up the controller and clicked over to the Cartoon Network, where an animated horse and rider were galloping through dark woods, chased by shadows. When he set the controller back on the side table, he noticed the empty bottle of gin on the floor. God damn it, Mom. Anton took another gulp of shake and crossed the living room. He needed to make sure she was sleeping on her side in case of a sudden ejection. She was not going to die like a rock star on his watch. On the kitchen counter, his cell phone chirruped. It was a text message from Jessica Elway. Now that she finally had the baby down for a nap, she planned to smoke a J and take off her clothes and avoid the TV and the internet, both of which were utterly freaky bizarro today. Was Anton interested in joining her? Her poor husband was stuck at a crime scene. 5. Frank Geary thought the guy currently starring in the New Mexico footage looked like an elderly refugee from Woodstock Nation, someone who should be leading the fish cheer instead of a freaky-deaky cult. Kinsman Brightleaf was what he called himself. How about that for a mouthful? He had a wild spread of curly gray hair, a curly gray beard, and wore a serape patterned in orange triangles that fell to his knees. Frank had followed the story of the Bright Ones as it developed over the spring, and come to the conclusion that beneath the pseudo-religious, quasi-political trappings, they were just another bunch of trumped-up tax dodgers. Emphasis on the Trump. Bright Ones, they called themselves, and oh, the fucking irony of that. There were about 30 of them, men and women and a few kids, who had declared themselves an independent nation. Besides refusing to pay taxes or send their kids to school or give up their automatic weapons, which they apparently needed to protect their ranch from the tumbleweeds, they had illegally diverted the only stream in the area onto the scrubland they owned. The FBI and the ATF had been parked outside their fences for months, attempting to negotiate a surrender, but nothing much had changed. The Bright One's ideology disgusted Frank. It was selfishness costumed in spirituality. You could draw a straight line from the Bright Ones to the endless budget cutting that threatened to turn Frank's own job into part-time employment or outright volunteer work. Civilization required a contribution, or a sacrifice, if that's what you wanted to call it. Otherwise, you ended up with wild dogs roaming the streets and occupying the seats of power in D.C. He wished, without, admittedly, a great deal of conviction, there were no kids in that compound so that the government could just roll on them and clean them out like the scum they were. Frank was at his desk in a small office, crowded in on all sides by animal cages of various sizes and shelves of equipment. It wasn't much of a space, but he didn't mind. It was okay. He sipped a bottle of mango juice and watched the TV as he held an ice pack against the side of the hand that he'd used to pound on Garth Flickinger's door. The light on his cell phone was blinking. Elaine. He wasn't sure how he wanted to play that, so he let her go to voicemail. He'd pushed too hard with Nana, he saw that now. Potentially, there could be blowback. A wrecked green Mercedes now sat in the driveway of a rich doctor. Frank's fingerprints were all over the painted paving stone he'd used to break the Merc's windows and beat on the Merc's body, as well as on the planter of the lilac tree that, at the height of his rage, he'd stuffed into the careless motherfucker's back seat. It was exactly the sort of incontrovertible evidence, felony vandalism, that a family court judge, all of whom favored the mother anyway, would need to fix it so he could only see his daughter for a supervised hour every other full moon. A felony vandalism rap would also take care of his job. What was obvious in retrospect was that Bad Frank had stepped in. Bad Frank had, in fact, had a party. But Bad Frank wasn't entirely bad, or entirely wrong, because, check it, for the time being, his daughter could safely draw in the driveway again. Maybe Good Frank could have handled it better, but maybe not. Good Frank was a bit of a weakling. I will not. We will not stand idly by while the so-called United States government perpetrates this hoax. On the television screen, Kinsman Brightleaf made his address from behind a long rectangular table. On the table lay a woman in a pale blue nightgown. Her face was shrouded in white stuff that looked like the fake webby crap they sold at the drugstore around Halloween. Her chest rose and fell. What is that shit? Frank asked the mongrel stray currently visiting with him. The mongrel looked up, then went back to sleep. It was a cliche, but for all-weather company, you couldn't do better than a dog. Couldn't do better than a dog, period. Dogs didn't know any better, they just made the best of it. They made the best of you. Frank had always had one growing up. Elaine was allergic to them, she claimed. Another thing he'd given up for her, far bigger than she could ever understand. Frank gave the mongrel a rub between the ears. We have observed their agents tampering with our water supply. We know that they have used their chemicals to act on the most vulnerable and treasured part of our family, the females of the Bright, in order to sow chaos and fear and doubt. They poisoned our sisters in the night. That includes my wife, my loving Susanna. The poison worked on her and our other beautiful women while they slept. Kinsman Brightleaf's voice bottomed out in a tobacco-scarred rattle that was oddly homey. It made you think of old men gathered around a diner table for breakfast, good-humored in their retirement. In attendance to the high priest of tax evasion were two younger men, also bearded, though less impressively, and also draped in serapes. all wore gun belts, making them look like extras in an old Sergio Leone spaghetti western. On the wall behind them was a Christ on the cross. The video from the compound was clear, marred only by the occasional line scrolling across the image.
While they slept. Do you see the cowardice of the current King of Lies? See him in the White House? See his many fellow liars on the useless green paper they want us to believe is worth something? Oh, my neighbors, 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 so wily and so cruel and so many faces.
All his teeth abruptly appeared, flashing from amid the wild crop of his beard.
But we will not succumb to the devil.
Hey now, thought Frank. Elaine thinks she has a problem with me. She should get a load of Jerry Garcia here. This guy's nuttier than a Christmas fruitcake.
The parlor tricks of Pilate's descendants are no match for the Lord we serve.
Praise God, murmured one of the militiamen.
That's right, praise him. Yes, sir.
Mr. Brightleaf clapped his hands.
So let's get this stuff off my missus.
One of his men passed him a set of poultry shears. Kinsman bent and began to carefully snip at the webbing that coated his wife's face. Frank leaned forward in his chair. He felt an uh-oh coming. 6. When he entered the bedroom and saw Magda lying under the covers, masked in what looked sort of like marshmallow fluff, Anton dropped to his knees beside her, banged the jar with his shake down on the nightstand, and, spying the trimmers, probably she had been clipping her eyebrows using her iPhone camera again, went right to work cutting it off. Had someone done this to her? Had she done it to herself? Was it some kind of bizarre accident? An allergic reaction? Some crazy beauty treatment gone wrong? It was confounding, it was scary, and Anton didn't want to lose his mother. Once the webbing was sliced open, he cast the bathroom trimmers aside and dug his fingers into the opening in the material. It was sticky, but the stuff peeled, stretching and separating from Magda's cheeks in gummy white whorls. Her worn face with its choppy wrinkles around the eyes, her dear face that Anton had momentarily been certain would be melted beneath the weird white coating. It was kind of like the fairy handkerchiefs he saw glistening in the grass in the dawn yards of the first couple of pools each day. Emerged unharmed. The skin was a bit flushed and warm to the touch, but otherwise she appeared no different than before. A low grumble began to come from inside her throat, almost a snore. Her eyelids were working, trembling from the movement of her eyes beneath the skin. Her lips opened and shut. A little spittle dripped from the corner of her mouth.
Mama? Mama? Can you wake up for me?
It seemed she could, because her eyes opened. Blood clouded the pupils, wafting across the sclera. She blinked several times. Her gaze shifted around the room. Anton slipped an arm under his mother's shoulders and raised her to a sitting position in the bed. The noise from her throat grew louder, not a snore now, but more like a growl.
Mama, should I call an ambulance? You want an ambulance? You want me to get a glass of water for you?
The questions came out in a rush. Anton was relieved, though. She continued to look around the bedroom, seeming to regain her bearings. Her gaze stopped on the nightstand. Faux Tiffany lamp, half-drunk jar of power shake, Bible, iPhone. The growling noise was louder. It was like she was building up to a yell or maybe a scream. Was it possible she didn't recognize him?
That's my drink, Mama.
Anton said as she reached out and grabbed hold of the jar with the shake.
No thanks to you, haha. You forget to make it, you goose.
She swung it, belting him across the side of his head, the connection a dull bonk of plastic finding bone. Anton tumbled backward, feeling pain and wet and bafflement. He landed on his knees, his sight focused on a green splatter on the beige carpet beneath him. Red dripped into the green.
What a mess, he thought.
Just as his mother hit him with the jar again, this time flush against the back of his skull. There was a sharper crack upon impact, the thick plastic of the blender jar splitting. Anton's face slammed forward into the shake splatter on the bristly mat of the beige carpet. He inhaled blood and shake and carpet fiber and threw out a hand to pull himself away, but every part of him, every wonderful muscle, had gone heavy and limp. A lion was roaring behind him, and if he was going to help his mother get away from it, he needed to get up and find the back of his head. He tried to call for Magda to run, but what came out was a gurgle, and his mouth was full of carpet. A weight fell on his spine, and as this new pain added itself to the old pain, Anton hoped that his mother had heard him, that she might yet escape. 7. A homeless dog started barking in one of the holding cages, and two others joined in. The nameless mongrel at his feet, so like the one Fritz Mischaum had smashed up, whined. It was now sitting up. Frank absently ran a hand along its spine, calming it. His eyes stayed locked on the screen. One of the young men attending Kinsman Brightleaf, not the one who'd handed him the poultry shears, the other one, grabbed his shoulder. "Dad, maybe you shouldn't do it." Brightleaf shrugged the hand away. "God says come into the light. Susanna, kinswoman Brightleaf, God says come into the light. Come into the light. Come into the light," echoed the man who'd passed the shears, and Brightleaf's son reluctantly joined in. "Come into the light, kinswoman Brightleaf, come into the light." Kinsman Brightleaf slid his hands into the cut cocoon covering his wife's face and thundered, "God says come into the light." He pulled. There was a ripping sound that reminded Frank of a Velcro strip letting go. The face of Mrs. Susanna Kinsman Brightleaf appeared. Her eyes were closed, but her cheeks were flushed, and the threads at the edges of the cut fluttered with her breath. Mr. Brightleaf leaned close, as if to kiss her. "Don't do that," Frank said, and although the TV sound wasn't high and he had spoken barely above a whisper, all the caged dogs, half a dozen of them this afternoon, were now barking. The mongrel made a low, worried sound. "Buddy, don't do that."
"Kinswoman Brightleaf, awake!"
She awoke, all right. And how? Her eyes flew open. She lunged upward and battened on her husband's nose. Kinsman Brightleaf screamed something that was bleeped out, but Frank thought it might have been "motherfucker." Blood sprayed. Kinswoman Brightleaf fell back onto the table with a sizable chunk of her husband's beak caught in her teeth. Blood dotted the bodice of her nightie. Frank recoiled. The back of his head struck the file cabinet crammed in behind his desk. One thought, irrelevant but very clear, filled his mind. The news network had bleeped out "motherfucker," but had permitted America to see a woman tear off a goodly portion of her husband's nose. Something in those priorities was badly screwed up. Cacophony in the room where the nose amputation had occurred. Shouts off camera, and then the camera tipped over, showing nothing but a wooden floor upon which a spatter of blood droplets was accumulating. Then it was back to Michaela Morgan, who looked grave. "Again, we apologize for the disturbing nature of this footage, and I want to repeat that we have not absolutely confirmed its authenticity, but we have late word that the Bright Ones have opened their gates, and the siege is over. This would seem to confirm that what you just saw really happened." She shook her head, as if to clear it, listened to something coming from the little plastic button in her ear, then said, "We are going to repeat this footage again on top of every hour. Not out of sensationalism." Yeah, right, Frank thought. As if. "But as a public service. If this is happening, people need to know one thing. If you have a loved one or a friend in one of these cocoons, do not attempt to remove it." Now back to George Alderson in the studio. "I've been told he has a very special guest who may be able to shed a bit more light on this terrible..." Frank used the remote to kill the TV. What now? What the fuck now? In Frank's little holding compound, dogs that had yet to be shipped to the Harvest Hills Animal Shelter continued to bark madly at the moth that fluttered and danced in the narrow corridor between their cages. Frank stroked the mongrel by his feet. "It's okay," he said. "Everything's all right." The dog stilled. Not knowing any better, it believed him. 8. Magda Dubček sat astride her son's corpse.
She had finished him off by sliding a green-streaked shard of the blender jar into the side of his neck, and made sure of it by driving another shard into the opening of his ear and all the way down his auditory canal until it buried itself in his brain. Blood continued to spurt from the wound in his neck, soaking the beige carpet in a larger and larger pool. Tears began to roll down her cheeks. Magda, at some strange distance, was dimly aware of them.
"Why is that woman crying?" she asked herself, not certain who it was that was crying or where. Come to think of it, where was Magda herself? Hadn't she been watching television and decided to have a rest? She wasn't in her bedroom now.
"Hello?" she asked the darkness that surrounded her. There were others in that darkness, many others. She thought she sensed them, but she couldn't see them. Maybe over here? Over there? Somewhere.
Magda probed outward.
She needed to find them. She couldn't be alone in here. If there were others, maybe they could help her get back home, to her son, to Anton. Her body rose from the corpse, elderly knees cracking. She stumbled to the bed and flopped down on it, her eyes closed. New white filaments began to unfurl from her cheeks, wavering, then falling gently down to the skin. She slept. She searched for the others in that other place. Chapter 6. 1. It was a hot afternoon, one that felt more like summer than spring, and all across Dueling, telephones were beginning to ring, as some of those who had been keeping up with the news called friends and relatives who had not. Others held back, sure the whole thing would turn out to be a tempest in a teapot, like Y2K, or an outright hoax, like the internet rumor that Johnny Depp was dead. As a result, many women who preferred music to TV put their infants and toddlers down for their afternoon naps, as always, and once their fussing had ceased, they lay down themselves. To sleep, and dream of other worlds than their own. Their female children joined them in these dreams. Their male children did not. The dream was not for them. When those hungry little boys awakened an hour or two later to find their mothers still slumbering, their loving faces enveloped in a sticky white substance, they would scream and claw and tear through the cocoons, and that would rouse the sleeping women. Ms. Leanne Barrows of 17 Eldridge Street, for example, wife of Deputy Reed Barrows. It was her habit to lie down for a nap with her 2-year-old son Gary around 11 each day. That's just what she must have done on the Thursday of Aurora. A few minutes after 2 o'clock, Mr. Alfred Freeman, the Barrows' neighbor at 19 Eldridge Street, a retired widower, was spraying his curbside hostas with deer repellent. The door of 17 Eldridge banged open, and Mr. Freeman observed Ms. Barrows as she staggered from her front door, carrying young Gary under her arm like a piece of siding. The boy, wearing only a diaper, was screaming and waving his arms. An opaque white mask covered most of his mother's face, except for a flap of material hanging loose from one corner of her mouth to her chin. It can be presumed that it was this rip that awakened the boy's mother and gained her far from pleasant attention. Mr. Freeman did not know what to say as Ms. Barrows made a beeline for him, as he stood 30 feet away just on the other side of the property line. For most of that morning, he had been gardening. He had not seen or heard the news. His neighbor's face, or absence of it, shocked him to silence. For some reason, at her approach, he removed his Panama hat and pressed it against his chest as if the national anthem were about to be played. Leanne Barrows dropped her bawling child into the plants at Alfred Freeman's feet, then swung around and returned across the lawn the way she had come, swaying drunkenly. White bits like shreds of tissue paper trailed from her fingertips. She re-entered her home and closed the door behind her. This phenomenon proved to be one of the most curious and most analyzed enigmas of Aurora,
the so-called mother's instinct, or foster reflex. While reports of violent interactions between sleepers and other adults ultimately numbered in the millions, and unreported interactions millions more, few, if any, occurrences of aggression between a sleeper and her pre-adolescent child were ever confirmed. Sleepers handed over their male infants and toddlers to the closest person they could find, or simply put them out of doors. They then returned to their places of slumber.
"Leanne?" Freeman called.
Gary rolled around on the ground, weeping and kicking the leaves with his fat pink feet.
"Mama! Mama!"
Alfred Freeman looked at the boy, then at the hosta he had sprayed, and asked himself, "Do I bring him back?" He was not a fan of children. He'd had two, and the feeling was mutual. He certainly had no use for Gary Barrows, an ugly little terrorist whose social graces seemed to extend no farther than waving around toy rifles and yelling about Star Wars. Leanne's face, screened in that white crap, made it seem that she wasn't really human at all. Freeman decided he would hang on to the kid until Leanne's deputy husband could be contacted to take charge. This was a life-saving choice. Those who challenged the mother's instinct regretted it. Whatever disposed Aurora mothers to peacefully seed their young male offspring, it was not receptive to questions. Tens of thousands learned this to their detriment, and then learned no more.
"Sorry, Gary," Freeman said. "I think you might be stuck with old Uncle Alf for a little bit."
He lifted the inconsolable child up by his armpits and brought him inside.
"Would it be too much to ask you to behave?"
2. Clint stayed with Evie through most of the intake process. Lila did not. He wanted her with him, wanted to keep emphasizing that she couldn't go to sleep, even though he'd started in on her as soon as she'd stepped out of her car in the prison parking lot. He'd told her half a dozen times already, and Clint knew his concern was testing her patience. He also wanted to ask her where she'd been the previous night, but that would have to wait. Considering developments both here and in the wider world, he wasn't sure it even mattered. Yet he kept coming back to it, like a dog licking a sore paw. Assistant Warden Lawrence, Lore, Hicks, arrived shortly after Evie was escorted into lockdown. Warden Coates left Hicks to handle the new intake's paperwork while she worked the phone, seeking guidance from the Bureau of Corrections and putting in calls to everybody on the off-duty roster. As it happened, there wasn't much to handle. Evie sat with her hands chained to the interview room table, still dressed, for the moment, in the county browns Lila and Lenny Mars had given her. Though her face was battered from repeated collisions with the mesh guard and Lila's cruiser, her eyes and mood were incongruously merry. To questions about her current address, relatives, and medical history, she gave back only silence. When asked for her last name, she said,
"I've been thinking about that. Let's say Black. Black will do. Nothing against Doe, a deer, a female deer, but Black seems a better one for Black times. Call me Evie Black."
"So it's not your real name?"
Fresh from the dentist, Hicks spoke from a mouth that was still mushy from Novocaine.
"You couldn't even pronounce my real name. Names."
"Give it to me anyway," Hicks invited.
Evie only looked at him with those merry eyes.
"How old are you?"
tried Hicks. Here, the woman's cheerful expression drooped into what appeared to Clint to be a look of sorrow.
"No age have I,"
she said, but then gave the assistant warden a wink, as if to apologize for something so orotund. Clint spoke up. There would be time for a full interview later, and in spite of everything that was going on, he could hardly wait. "Evie, do you understand why you are here?"
"To know God, to love God, and to serve God," Evie replied.
Then she raised her cuffed hands as far as the chain would allow, made a show of crossing herself, and laughed. She would say no more. Clint went to his office where Lila had said she'd wait for him. He found her talking into her shoulder mic. She replaced it and nodded at Clint.
"I've got to go. Thanks for taking her,"
I'll walk you out.
Don't want to stick with your patient?
Lila was already headed down the hall to the inner main door and lifting her face so Officer Millie Olson's monitors could see she was a citizen, Joan Law, in fact, and not an inmate. Clint said, "The strip search and de-lousing is ladies only. Once she's dressed, I'll rejoin." But you know all this, he thought. Are you too tired to remember, or do you just not want to talk to me? The door buzzed, and they went into the airlock-sized room between the prison and the foyer, a space so small it always gave Clint a mild case of claustrophobia. Another buzz, and they re-entered the land of free men and women, Lila leading. Clint caught up with her before she could go outside.
This Aurora, tell me again that I have to stay awake and I may scream.
She was trying to look good-humored about it, but Clint knew when she was struggling to keep her temper. It was impossible to miss the lines of strain around her mouth and the bags under her eyes. She had picked a spectacularly luckless time to work the night shift, if luck had anything to do with it. He followed her to the car, where Reed Barrows was leaning with his arms folded across his chest.
You're not just my wife, Lila. When it comes to law enforcement in Doolin County, you're the big kahuna.
He held out a hand with a piece of folded paper. Take this, and get it filled before you do anything else. Lila unfolded the piece of paper. It was a prescription.
What's Provigil?
He put an arm over her shoulder and held her close, wanting to be certain Reed didn't overhear their conversation.
It's for sleep apnea.
I don't have that.
No, but it'll keep you awake.
I'm not screwing around, Lila. I need you awake. And this town needs you awake. She stiffened under his arm.
Okay. Do it fast before there's a run.
Yes, sir. His orders, well meant as they might have been, clearly irritated her.
Just figure out my lunatic, if you can.
She managed to smile.
I can always hit the evidence locker. We've got mountains of little white pills.
This hadn't occurred to him. That's something to keep in mind. She pulled away.
I was kidding, Clint.
I'm not telling you to tamper with anything. I'm just telling you to... He held up his palms.
Keep it in mind. We don't know where this is going.
She looked at him doubtfully and opened the passenger door of the cruiser.
If you talk to Jared before I do, tell him I'll try to get home for dinner, but the chances are slim, approaching none.
She got in the car, and before she rolled up the window to take full advantage of the air conditioning, he almost popped the question, in spite of Reed Barrows' presence and in spite of the sudden, impossible crisis that the news insisted was possible. It was a question he supposed men had been asking for thousands of years. Where were you last night? But instead, he said, and momentarily felt clever,
Hey, hun, remember Mountain Rest? It might still be blocked up. Don't try the shortcut.
Lila didn't flinch, just said, Uh-huh, okay. Flapped a hand goodbye, and swung the cruiser toward the double gate between the prison and the highway. Clint, not so clever after all, could only watch her drive away. He got back inside just in time to see Evie, you couldn't even pronounce my real name, Black, get a photo snapped for her inmate ID. Don Peters then filled her arms with bedding.
You look like a stoner to me, darling. Don't puke on the sheets.
Hicks gave him a sharp look, but kept his Novocaine-numbed mouth shut. Clint, who'd had enough of Officer Peters to last a lifetime, did not.
Cut the shit.
Peters swiveled his head.
You don't tell me.
I can write up an incident report, if you want, Clint said. Inappropriate response. Unprovoked. Your choice. Peters glared at him, but only asked,
Since you're in charge of this one, what's her assignment?
A-10.
Come on, inmate, Peter said. You're getting a soft cell. Lucky you.
Clint watched them go, Evie with her arms full of bedding, Peters close behind. He watched to see if Peters would touch her, but of course he didn't. He knew Clint had an eye on him. 3. Lila had surely been this tired before, but she couldn't remember when. What she could remember, from health class in high school, for God's sweet sake, were the adverse consequences of long-term wakefulness. Slowed reflexes, impaired judgment, loss of vigilance, irritability, not to mention short-term memory problems, such as being able to recall facts from sophomore health, but not what the fuck you were supposed to do next, today, this minute. She pulled into the parking lot of the Olympia Diner.
"My, oh my, try our egg pie," read the easel sign by the door.
Turned off her engine, got out, and took long, slow, deep breaths, filling her lungs and bloodstream with fresh oxygen. It helped a little. She leaned in her window, grabbed her dash mic, then thought better of it. This was not a call she wanted going out over the air. She replaced the mic and pulled her phone from its pocket on her utility belt. She punched one of the dozen or so numbers she kept on speed dial.
"Lenny, how are you doing?"
"Okay, got 7 hours or so last night, which is a little more than usual, so all good."
"I'm worried about you, though."
"I'm fine, don't worry about—" She was interrupted by a jaw-cracking yawn. It made what she was saying a bit ludicrous, but she persevered.
"I'm fine, too."
"Seriously? How long have you been awake?"
"I don't know, maybe 18, 19 hours?"
To reduce Lenny's concern, she added, "I cooped some last night, don't worry." Lies kept falling out of her mouth. There was a fairy tale that warned about this, about how one lie led to other lies and you eventually turned into a parakeet or something, but Lila's worn-out brain couldn't come up with it.
"Never mind me right now. What's the deal with Tiffany What's-Her-Face from the trailer? Did the EMTs transport her to the hospital?"
"Yes, good thing they got her there fairly early." Lenny lowered her voice. "St. Teresa's is a madhouse."
"Where are Roger and Terry now?"
Lenny's response to this question was embarrassed.
"Well, they waited for the assistant DA for a while, but he never showed, and they wanted to check on their wives."
"So they left the crime scene?" Lila was furious for a moment, but her anger had dissipated by the time her disbelief was expressed. Probably the reason the ADA hadn't shown was the same reason that Roger and Terry had left, to check on his wife. It wasn't just St. Teresa's that was a madhouse. It was everywhere.
"I know, Lila, I know, but Roger's got that baby girl, you know."
If it's his, Lila thought. Jessica Elway liked to bedhop, that was the word around town. And Terry was panicking, too, and neither of them could get an answer when they called home. "I told them you'd be pissed."
"All right, get them back. I want them to go to all three drugstores in town and tell the pharmacists."
Pinocchio. That was the fairy tale about lying. And he didn't turn into a parakeet. His nose grew until it was as long as Wonder Woman's dildo. "Lila, are you still there?"
"Pull it together, woman." "Tell the pharmacists to use discretion on all the speedy stuff they've got. Adderall, dexedrine, and I know there's at least one prescription methamphetamine, although I can't remember the name."
"Prescription meth? Shut up!"
"Yes, the pharmacists will know. Tell them to use discretion. Prescriptions are going to be pouring in. The fewest number of pills they can give people until we understand what in the hell is going on here. Got it?"
"Yes." "One other thing, Lenny, and this is just between us. Look in evidence. See what we've got in there for speed-up stuff. And that includes the coke and Black Beauties from the Griner Brothers bust."
"Jeepers, are you sure? There's almost half a pound of Bolivian marching powder. Lowell and Maynard, they're due to go on trial. Don't want to mess that up. We've been after them, like, forever."
"I'm not sure at all, but Clint put the idea in my head, and now I can't get it out. Just inventory the stuff, okay? No one's going to start rolling up dollar bills and snorting. Not this afternoon, anyway."
"Okay." Lenny sounded awed.
"Who's out at that trailer where the meth lab exploded?"
"Just a minute, let me check Gertrude." Lenny called her office computer Gertrude for reasons Lila did not care to understand.
"Forensics and the FD units have departed. I'm surprised they left the scene so soon."
Lila wasn't. Those guys probably had wives and daughters, too.
Looks like a couple of odd dudes might still be around, putting out the last of the hotspots. Can't say for sure which ones. All I've got is a note saying they rolled out of Maylock at 11:33.
Willie Burke's probably one of them, though. You know Willie, he never misses." AH, an acronym that came out sounding like a sigh, was the Tri-County's Adopt-a-Highway crew, mostly retirees with pickup trucks. They were also the closest thing the Tri-Counties had to a volunteer fire department, and often came in handy during brush fire season.
"Okay, thanks."
"Are you going out there?"
Lenny sounded faintly disapproving, and Lila wasn't too tired to catch the subtext. With all this other stuff going on? Lenny, if I had a magic wake-up wand, believe me, I'd use it.
Okay, Sheriff.
Subtext, don't bite my head off.
Sorry, it's just that I've got to do what I can do. Presumably someone, a bunch of someones, is working on this sleeping sickness thing at the Disease Control Center in Atlanta. Here in Dueling, I've got a double murder, and I need to work on that.
Why am I explaining all this to my dispatcher? Because I'm tired, that's why. And because it's a distraction from the way my husband was looking at me back at the prison. And because it's a distraction from the possibility, fact, really, Lila, not a possibility, but a fact, and that fact's name is Sheila, that the husband you're so concerned about isn't anybody you really knew anyway. Aurora, they were calling it. If I fall asleep, Lila thought, will that be the end? Will I die? Could be, as Clint might say. Could fucking be. The good-natured back and forth they had always had, the ease of their collaborations on projects and meals and parenting responsibilities, the comfortable pleasure they'd taken from each other's bodies, these repeated experiences, the marrow of their daily life together, had turned crumbly. She pictured her husband smiling, and it made her stomach sick. It was the same smile that Jared had, and it was Sheila's smile, too. Lila remembered how Clint had quit his private practice without a word of discussion. All the work they'd done planning his office, the care that they had put into choosing not just the location but also the town, ultimately selecting Dueling because it was the biggest population center in the area that didn't have a psychiatrist with a general practice. But Clint's second patient had annoyed him, so he had decided on the spot that he needed to make a change, and Lila had just gone along. The wasted effort had bothered her. The resultant lowering of their financial prospects had meant a lot of recalculating. And all things being equal, she would much rather have lived closer to a city than in the rural tri-counties. But she had wanted Clint to be happy. She had just gone along. Lila hadn't wanted a pool. She had gone along. One day, Clint had decided that they were switching to bottled water and filled up half of the refrigerator with the stuff. She had gone along. Here was a prescription for Provigil that he had decided she needed to take. She would probably go along. Maybe sleep was her natural state. Maybe that was why she could accept Aurora, because for her, it was not much of a change. Could be. Who the hell knew? Had Evie been there last night? Was that possible? Watching the AAU game in the Coughlin High gym as the tall blonde girl went in for layup after layup, cutting through Fayette's defense like a sharp blade? That would explain the triple-double thing, wouldn't it? Kiss your man before you go to sleep. Yes, this is probably how you started to lose your mind. Lenny, I have to go. She ended the call without waiting for a reply and reholstered her phone. Then she remembered Jared and pulled the phone back out. Only what to tell him? And why bother? He had the internet on his phone, they all did. By now, Jer probably knew more about what was going on than she herself. Her son. At least she had a son, not a daughter. That was something to be thankful for today. Mr. and Mrs. Pack must be going crazy. She texted Jer to come straight home from school, and that she loved him, and left it at that. Lila turned her face up to the sky and took more deep breaths. After almost a decade and a half of cleaning up the results of bad behavior, much of it drug-related, Lila Norcross was confident enough in her status and position to know that, although she would do her job to the best of her ability, she had very little personal stake in obtaining justice for a couple of dead meth chefs who, one way or another, had probably been destined to electrocute themselves on the great bug light of life. And she was politically savvy enough to know that nobody was going to be yelling for a quick solve, not with this panic-inducing Aurora thing going on. But the trailer out by Adam's Lumberyard was where Evie Doe had made her Dueling County debut, and Lila did have a personal stake in freaky Evie. She hadn't dropped out of thin air. Had she left a car out there? Possibly one with an owner's registration in the glove compartment? The trailer was less than 5 miles away, no reason not to have a look-see. Only something else needed doing first. She went into the Olympia. The place was nearly deserted, both waitresses sitting at a corner booth gossiping. One of them saw Lila and started to get up, but Lila waved her back. Gus Vereen, the owner, was planted on a stool by the cash register, reading a Dean Koontz paperback. Behind him was a small TV with the sound muted. Across the bottom of the screen ran a crawl reading, "Aurora Crisis Deepens." "I read that one," Lila said, tapping his book. "The dog communicates using Scrabble tiles." "Now you gone and spoiled it for me," Gus said. His accent was as thick as red-eye gravy. "Sorry. You'll like it anyway. Good story. Now that we've got the literary criticism out of the way, coffee to go, black, make it an XL. He went to the bun and filled a large go-cup. It was black, all right. Probably stronger than Charles Atlas and as bitter as Lila's late Irish granny. Fine with her. Gus slipped a cardboard heat sleeve to the halfway point, snapped on a plastic cap, and handed it to her. But when she reached for her wallet, he shook his head. "No charge, Sharp." "Yes, charge." It was an unbreakable rule, one summarized by the plaque on her desk reading, "No fat cops stealing apples." Because once you started taking stuff on the arm, it never stopped. And there was always a quid pro quo. She laid a five on the counter. Gus pushed it back. "It ain't the badge, Sharp. Free coffee for all the women folk today." He glanced at his waitresses. "Ain't that so?" "Yes," one of them said, and approached Lila. She reached into the pocket of her skirt. "And dump this in your coffee, Sheriff Norcross. It won't help the taste any, but it'll jumpstart you." It was a packet of Goody's headache powder. Although Lila had never used it, she knew Goody's was a Tri-County's staple, right up there with Rebel Yell and cheese-covered hash browns. When you tore open the envelope and poured out the contents, what you had looked pretty much like the baggies of coke they'd found in the Griner brothers' back shed, wrapped in plastic and stored in an old tractor tire, which was why they, and plenty of other dealers, used Goody's to cut their product. It was cheaper than Pedialax.
32 milligrams of caffeine, the other waitress said. I had two already today. I ain't going to sleep until the brat boys solve this Aurora shit. No way.
4. One of the great benefits of being Dueling County's one and only animal control officer, maybe the only benefit, was having no boss lording it over him. Technically, Frank Geary answered to the mayor and the town council, but they almost never came to his little corner around the rear side of the nondescript building that also housed the Historical Society, the Recreation Department, and the assessor's office, which was fine with him. He got the dogs walked and quieted down. There was nothing like a handful of Dr. Tim's doggy chicken chips for that. Made sure they were watered, and checked that Maisie Wettermore, the high school volunteer, was due in at 6 to feed them and take them out again. Yes, she was on the board. Frank left her a note concerning various medications, then locked up and left. It did not occur to him until later that Maisie might have more important things on her mind than a few homeless animals. It was his daughter he was thinking about. Again. He'd scared her that morning. He didn't like to admit it, even to himself, but he had. Nana. Something about her had started to nag him. Not the Aurora, exactly, but something related to the Aurora. What was it? "I'll return Elle's call," he thought. "I'll do it just as soon as I get home." Only what he did first when he got to the little four-room house he was renting on Ellis Street was to check the fridge. Not much going on in there. 2 yogurt cups, a moldy salad, a bottle of Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce, and a case of Miner's Daughter oatmeal stout, a high-calorie tipple which he assumed must be healthy. It had oatmeal in it, didn't it? As he grabbed one, his phone went. He looked at Elaine's picture on the little screen and had a moment of clarity he could have done without. He feared the wrath of Elaine, a little, and his daughter feared the wrath of Daddy, only a little, he hoped. Were these things any basis for a family relationship? "I'm the good guy here," he reminded himself, and took the call. "Hey, Al. Sorry I didn't get back to you sooner, but something came up. Presad, I had to put Judge Silver's cat down, and then..." Elaine wasn't about to be put off by the subject of Judge Silver's cat. She wanted to get right into it with him. and as usual, she had her volume turned up to 10 right from the jump.
You scared the crap out of Nana. Thank you very much for that.
Calm down, okay? All I did was tell her to draw her pictures inside because of the green Mercedes.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Frank.
Remember when she first got the paper route, and she said she had to swerve onto the Nadelhoff's lawn because some guy driving a big green car with a star on the front went up onto the sidewalk? You told me to let it go, and I did. I let it go.
The words were spilling out faster and faster. Soon he'd be spitting them if he didn't get control of himself. What Elaine didn't understand was that sometimes he had to shout to be heard. With her, at least.
The car that took out Judge Silver's cat was also a big green car with a star on the front. A Mercedes. I was pretty sure I knew who it belonged to when Nana had her close call.
Frank, she said it swerved onto the sidewalk half a block down.
Maybe so. Or maybe it was closer and she didn't want to scare us. Didn't want us to take away her paper route right after she got it. Just listen, okay? I let it go. I'd seen that Mercedes around the neighborhood many times, but I let it go.
How many times had he said that?
And why did it remind him of that song from Frozen, the one Nana had gone around singing until he'd been quite sure it would drive him mad? He was clutching the can of stout so hard he dented it, and if he didn't stop, he'd pop it wide open.
But not this time. Not after he ran over Coco.
Who's
Coco? Coco, Judge Silver's cat. That could have been my kid, Elaine. Our kid. Long story short, that Mercedes belongs to Garth Flickinger right up the hill.
The doctor?
Elaine sounded engaged, at last.
That's him. And when I talked to him, guess what? He was high, Elaine. I'm almost positive. He could barely form sentences.
Instead of reporting him to the police, you went to his house? Like you went to Nana's school that time and shouted at her teacher when all the kids, including your daughter, could hear you ranting like a crazy person?
Go ahead, drag it up, Frank thought, clenching the can harder. You always do. That, or the famous wall punch, or the time I told your father he was full of shit. Drag it up, drag it out. Elaine Nutting Geary's greatest hits. When I'm in my coffin, you'll be telling somebody about the time I hollered at Nana's second-grade teacher after she made fun of Nana's science project and made my daughter cry in her room. And when that one gets tired, you can reminisce about the time I yelled at Mrs. Fenton for spraying her weed killer where my daughter had to breathe it in while she was riding her trike. Fine. Make me the bad guy if that's what gets you through the day. But right now, I will keep my voice calm and level, because I can't afford to let you push my buttons this time. Elaine, somebody has to watch out for our daughter, and it's pretty clear you're not up to the job. It was my duty as a father.
Did that sound pompous? Frank didn't care.
I have no interest in seeing him arrested on a misdemeanor charge of feline hit and run, but I do have an interest in making sure he doesn't run down Nana. If scaring him a little accomplished that,
tell me you didn't go all Charles Bronson.
No, I was very reasonable with him.
That was at least close to true. It was the car he hadn't been reasonable with. But he was sure a hotshit doc like Flickinger had mucho insurance.
Frank, she said.
What?
I hardly know where to start.
Maybe with the question you didn't ask when you saw Nana drawn in the driveway.
What? What question?
Why are you home from school, honey? That question.
Not in school. Maybe that was what had been nagging at him. It was so sunny this morning, I just seemed like summer. You know, I forgot it was May.
You have got your head so far the wrong way around, Frank. You're so concerned about your daughter's safety, and yet you can't even remember that it's the school year. Think about that. Haven't you noticed the homework she does at your house? You know, those notebooks she writes in and the textbooks she reads? With God and his only son, Jesus, as my witness.
He was willing to take a lot, and he was willing to admit he maybe deserved some, but Frank drew the line with the Jesus as my witness shit. God's only son wasn't the one who had gotten that raccoon out from under the Episcopalian church all those years ago and nailed the board over the hole, and he didn't put clothes on Nana's back or food in her stomach, not to mention Elaine's. Frank did those things, and there had been no magic to it.
Cut to the chase, Elaine.
You don't know what's going on with anyone but yourself. It's all about what's pissing Frank off today. It's all about who doesn't understand that only Frank knows how to do things right, because those are your default positions.